Good evening. At this time, we begin the 6909 deploy mark. 9K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And with the assistance of Mel, K2KEY, we intend to run a 6-10 in which most of your questions will be answered. No guarantee on all of them. But there's a lot to learn about this wireless technology and ham radio in general. And the subjects that are of interest to electronic enthusiasts, particularly ham radio electronic enthusiasts, those are the kind of things that are appropriate for this particular TechNet. A person signs in by giving me and Mel your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Since we have any check-ins at this time, please give me your call letters and name.
KB2MAR Gabe, yes.
W2 Tango 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 Gordon, no, but good evening, Dick.
Whiskey 2 Papa November Juliet, yes.
And Mr. PNJ, what is your name, sir?
To handle this bomb, Dick, thank you.
Pretty fine, Bob. So far we've got Gabe, Gordon, and Bob. Who else would like to check in? Call it in the name, please.
W2N Paul. That's the sign, good evening, sir.
MPT, Steve, and no questions to type in.
Thank you, Neo. Diana, no questions.
KC2, O-R-O, Mike, no questions.
Man, KC2, Mike.
Okay, that time we picked up, let's see, after Gordon, Bob, we picked up Paul, Steve, Diane, and Mike. And I think, Paul, I know he's going to be giving us a space report. I believe Steve said no. I think Diane said she's listening. Glad she's there. And Mike, did you say yes or no with reference to question or comment?
Good evening, Dick. No questions.
W2TTT has a question, but hide that. Okay. Gordon started off with a no, but now he has a yes. This guy's going to develop more questions as time goes on. Let's start off with Gabe. Gabe, KB2MAL, what would you like to tell us about tonight, ask about tonight? No guarantees, but the price is right. K2RIW in the segment.
K2RIW, KB2MAR. Is anybody on the net? My question concerns a cable from SSB Electronics, a German cable called EcoFlex 15. I was wondering if anyone can move that cable on the net. And can you use your standard TL-259 mirror connector on that type of cable, or do you have to use SSB Electronics cable? KB2MAR back to net.
Okay, SSB, nice company, imports an awful lot of good German equipment. My 10 gig transverter, which transverts from 10.368 gigs down to 144 megs, was made by SSB Electronics. And bought that way back in the dark ages of 1990 and very pleased with it. I know that they have a number of foreign-made, low-loss coax cables, semi-flexible and flexible coax cables. The one person I know who was dealing with a number of those foreign cables was Rich in 2EO. And Rich, I wonder if you're available tonight because you might have specific information about the kind of cable that Gabe is talking about. Let's hope that Rich is there. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, it looks like Rich hasn't signed in yet. Gabe, give us the model number one more time. Also, have you done a web search on that cable, that model number? Sometimes you go to Google and just write down nothing but the model number. It may be a 2N5421, for instance. You just write down 2N5421, and off comes the data sheet. Google is very good at that. So if the cable has a model number, give that a try. And if not, I can think of a number of other ways. So what searching have you done so far? And your signal is a little bit noisy this time. I think you're using a handy token. You might want to stand in a slightly different spot, Gabe. So give us the model number of that cable one more, time. KB2MAR, I think I've got it right this time. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
How copy?
Quite a bit better, Gabe. Go right ahead. What's the cable number?
Ecoflex 15 millimeter diameter. It has a your pistol weighted shield on the outside, full copper grill on the inside, storm insulation, high purity center conductor, one of the 99% oxygen free type of conductors, standard of course. And it's very, very flexible. And I've a Torax loss for that cable, and I believe it's half the loss of your typical RG Cooper, RG Cooper cable unit cross from the Belden type cable. It's half the loss. Let's say for between like 20 megahertz and 30 megahertz, it's like 0.2 something dB as opposed to like 3.8 or 4.2 dB back to you.
35 Gabe, it's a very desirable sounding cable. You did say 15 millimeters, and I'm going to assume that means outside diameter. And for those who are not quite as metricated as they'd like to be, 39.37 inches is 1 meter, a little bit longer than a yard. So you take 0.039, first of all, 39.37 inches is a meter, a millimeter, a thousandth of that. You move it three decimal places over, it's 0.039.37. Multiply that by 15, and you come up with 0.585 inches. So it's a little bit over half an inch. On normal cables, on RG 213, 214, and RG 8, I think are a little bit closer to the 440 or so thousandths of an inch, 0.44. So the 0.585 that I just calculated for 15 millimeters tells me that most likely that cable will not go into a PL-259. If you stripped away the rubber and only had just the outer braid, you may be able to make it work. By the way, when you're below 432 megacycles, whatever you put on as a connector, your highest priority is for it to have good mechanical strength. The second highest priority is to have, if it's outdoors, to have weatherproofing. The third highest priority is to make sure it mates with everything else you've got, your antennas, your adapters, and so on, in the back of your rig. Your fourth priority, way downrange, is to worry about what is the impedance match of the connector. Of course, that's going to sound crazy, but let me tell you where I'm coming from on that one. Almost every connector you and I can get our hands on rarely is more than 1 inch long. They're more like 0.7, 0.8, 0.9 inches long. On 432, a wavelength is 27 inches, so therefore the connector is way under a 27th of a wavelength. And you study a Smith chart or the mathematical equivalent of that, and you'll find out that if you're putting in the wrong impedance of cable, but the length is only 1/27th of a wavelength, which is probably, what, 15 degrees in phase or something like that. When you're putting in that small a length of cable, whether the cable has a 10-ohm, 50-ohm, 90-ohm, or 140-ohm impedance, does not matter. The amount of viswar it creates, a 1.0 viswar on the cable because of that connector and it being so short, even with a great big mismatch, it's going to give you a 1.15. Almost all circumstances, that's very negligible. So that's the reason why the impedance of the connector, if you're below 432, doesn't matter. Go up to 10 gigs, where the wavelength is 1 inch, and now the connector is almost an inch long, yeah, you better be very careful about the impedance. It's now going to make a huge bump in your system. But from 432 and 2 meters on down, you can get away with murder. So any connector that you can force to work to meet the first three criteria, good mechanical connection, weatherproofing, and the mate with everything you've got, will work. And there are guys who will take their favorite cable, and they will, say for instance, I went and bought now a piece of 1 5/8 Andrew Heliax, which by the way sells for $120 a foot. So assume that my favorite cable is 1 5/8 on Andrew Heliax, and I don't want to buy the connector, which is around $350, and make that connector go down to adapt from that cable down to a UG21, a type N connector, or a PL-259. if I home brewed a connector out of sheets of copper and pieces of copper tubing or brass tubing from a hobby shop and whatever, if I home brewed a connector for that cable, and a lot of hands have done it, with a little bit of craftiness, it can work like a charm on 2 meters and down. So don't be afraid of home brewing. Look at all the stuff you've got in the hardware store, and there's probably a way you can make a connector out of it. This is based on the assumption that you don't know where to buy the connector, or when you do find the connector, it's either got a 3-month lead time and a $100 minimum order, or it's too expensive, or whatever. So you've got lots of ways you can go on this one, Gabe, and you're not as bad off as you think. And that cable having such beautiful performance, I can see why you'd like to use it. So I bet you SSB does make a connector for it. If they sell the cable, I'm sure they sell either the cable with connectors already installed or the connector for it. So I'm going to pass it back to you, Gabe, for you to tell us whether or not the SSB that you order it from also mentions the appropriate connector. But drag your feet a little bit in case one of the crafty guys in the background is going to come forward and say, hey, Gabe, this is the solution to the problem. So KP2MAR with a little bit of delay, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, KQKY.
Go right ahead, Mel. Bet you he's got a solution. He's got a crafty way of getting around all these problems. You got it, Mel.
Now, Roger, there was an article that was, I think, was in Ham Radio. I have to look at my file. And it shows you how to make up the adapter using an end connector, on. And you can buy the fitting. I have to buy a few fittings that is sold. I guess you can get it in a place that sells like fittings for air compressors, or maybe an automotive. It's a number of types of together fittings. But the adapter actually is, you can adapt an end connector by using that method to a number of different cables. I have to look and see if I can find in the file what when the article was printed. But it was a very crafty way of using standard parts to adapt end connectors to a number of different cable diameters and sensors. Over.
Okay, good suggestion. And while we're at it, my favorite cable when it comes to long run, low loss VHF and UHF frequencies, you cannot, positively cannot beat the price of 3/4 inch diameter or 7/8 inch diameter cable TV hardline cable. The stuff that runs up and down the block for your cable TV system, the so-called, I call it messenger cable, I don't know what they call it, but the cable TV system between the phone poles sends up this hard line. They buy it in 5,000 foot reels. When there's about 150 foot left on the end of the reel, they take all of those reels with 150 foot left on the end and bring it back to their stockyard. And when those reels pile up too high, they throw them away. You cannot beat the insertion loss of that cable without going to Andrew Heliac's and buying 7/8 inch cable and probably paying, 50 cents a foot or some huge price. And you can get this stuff essentially for free. You go to your nearest stockyard that, where they house the equipment for cable TV. You ask them, is there any mill ends left over? In other words, are there any 100, 150 foot or whatever left over on the end of the reel? And sometimes you hand the guy a $5 bill just as a nuisance fee, and sometimes you don't even have to do that. And he says, you go ahead and take a couple of them. I've got about 2,000 feet of that stuff on my property, and I must have about 500 feet of it in the air on my tower. And the first thing you're going to say is, hey, that's 75 ohm cable. You've got a 50 ohm system. And it doesn't matter. I put a piece of tape on the cable, I write 50 ohms on it, I make sure that that side of the cable faces toward the transmitter, and the transmitter never knows the difference. That's a little bit of a joke. But in reality, the worst case that can happen on a 50 ohm system, you put a 75 ohm cable in there, you develop a 1.5 standard wave ratio, just a cable mismatch. Of course, you end up with much lower loss. And this cable is really rugged stuff. It's made for direct burial in the ground for 20 years. If that's what you want to do with it, to run from the house up to the tower. That's exactly what I'm doing. I've got a whole lot of it buried in the ground, and I'm working like a charm. So here is my fighting some of that cable right now. And the connectors for the incident, they call them stinger connectors. They made to go from the 3/4-inch hard line into the boxes that contain their amplifier. Look at that connection tape, the Reader's University. It just happens to have a 5/8-24 grid on the outside of the stinger connector. And by the way, the cable company is throwing away stinger connectors all the time, the garbage. Whenever they take a part of the protective cable, they replace the connectors with brand new ones before we have the old ones. And there's nothing wrong with the old ones. You can take them apart, clean the dirt out of them, put some new silicon grease on the rubber steel inside, and it will be good for the next 20 years. I've got a lot of diplomatic techniques taking out of the garbage. 5/8-24 grid on the front end of the finger connector just happens to the back of the 21 type N connector. The cable, male connector on the type N, that you put on the type N, and you put on the end of your RG8 or RG13, that's got the exact same thread as the finger connector. So when you install the finger connector on the hard line, you install your G21 on the end of the finger, and the center pin coming out of the finger connector, you cut up the right length, got around the center pin of your type N connector, and you're up and running. I've got quite a few of those. I was thinking about taking some of those. So there's the lowest cost cable in the world, hardline, home filled. You can get it for free. If you're a little bit crafty, quite a few hands are using it. So that's just another example of how adapting connectors and inexpensive low cost cables sometimes can do great things. Now, not everybody likes hardline. If you have to string it through the house, you've got to go through the rafter, holes in the rafters and whatever. Hardline is a little bit of a pain, it's kind of hard. But when it comes to outdoor work going up the tower, in my opinion, there's nothing better. So, do you remember, Gabe, whether or not SSD does sell a connector? If you sell the cable, most likely somewhere in their catalog, they probably have an online catalog, somewhere in there, they probably also sell the connector. Keep QMA on for any other info or questions. HYWMFECNET.
Yes, they do. They sell a solder connector to the cable. It runs between $8 and $10 each. And I believe it has a type N connector at one end. I think there's another one that they sell. I forgot which one it was, but it was in a PLC-59. I did recall seeing one on the internet someplace, but I don't know if I would trust it to fit on that cable the way they were designed there to fit on the cable, you know what I mean? So, maybe, by the way, I've seen the advertising for 15mm, but I think I looked into the fine detail, I think it's at 14.5. I think they just spiced it a little bit to make it look even more pleasant, but it might be 14.5, and maybe if you get to scrape some of the polyethylene and back it off a little bit, you can probably pull it on a PLC-59 and solder it in. Because I prefer to solder it. You can't, if you have to use a push on, maybe I can just put some plastic there into the joint. Then
you put the heat shrink
over it. Back to you.
Very fine, Dave. Yeah, I do hear you say you really want a solder on connector or a connector that's got a real collet mechanism to it where you hold over the foil and the braid and whatever, like on a type N connector. So-called solderless connectors, Krypton connectors. On indoor service, they're probably great. On outdoor service, I do not trust them. And maybe it's just me, and maybe I'm being an old fogey on this one, but when it comes to Krypton connectors that were tested for semi-rigid cable, the 141.141 diameter semi-rigid cable that's very popular on military hardware, the factory I was working for tried a number of those by crimping them on, following the manufacturer's recommendations, putting them into a salt spray machine for 1 week, simulates about 5 or 10 years of service on a seafront atmosphere, so to speak, like we've got here on Long Island. And a significant number of them did fail microwave Vizoir test after the salt spray. So I'm not an enthusiast of Krypton connectors. The people who love Krypton connectors like the fact that you can install the connector in a few seconds as opposed to a piece of RG214, the double braided RG8-like cable. By the time you, with hand tools, properly prepare that cable, comb out the braid, put it through the collet mechanism, trim it correctly, put it all together, you're going to spend no 10 minutes of your life installing one single connector. And properly installing that connector, even with the right tools, right hand tools, not the specific ones made exactly for the connector, but the ones you and I have gotten our toolbox, it takes 10 minutes and it's an art form to do it well. That doesn't bother me, because you install that connector correctly with the right connector, and it will serve you for 10 or 15 years. Whereas the crimp connector, which saves you the 10 minutes, it may fail in a year and a half outdoors. So in my opinion, that's a false economy. So my opinion, and not everyone's going to agree with me on this one, is that take your time and install a connector that's known to have a track record for a good weatherproofing and good mechanical strength in an outdoor service. Outdoor service on cables is very tough if you're a VHF operator. On 80 meters, you can get away with water in a connector. You get two or three drops of water in the center of a tight end connector on 432, and it will cause you 10 to 15 decibels of loss, two S units of loss. And I'm not kidding. I've measured it myself. And I tried boiling away the water by putting in a kilowatt of power. Don't do it. You're wasting your time. You make a big white pasty mess in the process. So keeping water out of the connectors on outdoor service is something you've got to really worry about. And when it comes to foam-filled cables, don't only look at the insertion loss. There are a number of cables, like, for instance, FM8, and I can't think of the name of this one that's very popular now, which has got air going down the center. Does somebody remember that? The RG8 sine cable with air going down the center that's quite popular, low loss?
9913.
And go on, 9913. Now, there is a new version of 9913, thank you, sir, which has a foil on the outside of the braid or inside of the braid, and if that foil is done correctly, it gives you hermetic steel. But any of the cables that are foam filled and have nothing but a outer braid, I don't care if it's one or two layers of outer braid, and then polyethylene. The polyethylene jacket is a weather seal, not a hermetic seal. All foam filled cables must breathe. On a hot day, the air inside the foam expands, on a cold day, it contracts and sucks in water. So all foam-filled cables that do not have a hermetically sealed foil on the outside are only good for a couple of years. The 9913 has a lot of air in the center, which will breathe, and as such, it's going to suck in water. And there's a lot of horror stories of people with 9913 with water pouring out of one end of the cable. And you get a few drops of water in the 9913, you're going to get a lot of loss. Water is a beautiful dummy load at 2 meters. At 2 meters and above. But you gotta keep the water out of the cable. So, if it takes you $8 to $10 on a connector, and the connector is known to have good weather sealing for that particular cable, and if the foam-filled cable itself has a foil to keep the water out, you got a good combination. But if it's just a flexible cable with nothing but a braid on the outside, setting out the outer conductor, and foam is a dielectric, I don't care what kind of rubber-like substance you've got on the outside, that rubber-like substance will slowly breathe water. And as the water slowly goes into the foam, the loss of the cable starts climbing real fast. And the insertion loss of the cable, however number of dBs it was when it's brand new, when water gets into the foam, you can easily have the number of dBs per 100 feet go 2 to 3 times higher a couple of years downrange. I've experienced that on a very well-made brand of FM8 cable. Federal was the brand name. It was intended to be used for military systems. It was a popular cable way back in the late 70s. Very low-loss RG8-sized cable, foam-filled, but there was nothing to keep the water from slowly migrating through the outer jacket, through the braid, and into the foam. And when I took down my 432 array and measured those insertion loss of those cables, that were part of the phasing harness, boy, did I get a surprise. No wonder the signals were slowly getting weaker, and it happened so slowly I didn't even know it, so to speak. So that's something to be concerned about. Weatherproofing first, mechanical strength second, matching your system third, and the right impedance is the fourth thing on your priority list, from my point of view, Gabe. Thank you for any of the questions or comments. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the tech net.
That's pretty much the answer to all my questions. The only problem is that this copper business today is very expensive. So, I think a 300 meter, what's a 300 meter? 300 meter spool sells for about 450.
He's got water in his coax now.
And, I don't think I'm making that much, but I gotta see the price of copper. All these important cables have copper in them and everything. It's just ridiculous. And maybe next week I'll come and speak with Richard. I think you'll have all the more deeper information regarding getting the right answer for the wire for the cable. I think a bunch of experience in using a 259 that I think you might know all the more information. H-R-I-W.
Gabe, if you haven't bought that cable yet, do spend a couple of days trying to find somebody at the local stockyard for your cable company, whether it be NASA or somebody, and see if you can get 150 feet of free, three-quarter inch or 7/8 inch cable. And by the way, they do not call it three-quarter inch cable. They call it 750 cable. You gotta use their vocabulary, otherwise they don't know what the heck you're talking about. Three-quarter inch diameter hardline cable used by the cable company. They call it 750. And the 7/8 inch diameter cable, they probably call it 875. So you ask them, do they have any spare 750 or 875 hardline cable in their stockyard? And most likely you'll get it for $10 for a great big reel of it, just for a nuisance fee, so to speak, or absolutely free. You will not get lower loss than that. The 7/8 inch diameter cable runs something like 1.5 kV for 100 feet at 432. And 2 meters, it probably runs something in the vicinity of 3/4 of a dB per 100 feet. You ain't going to beat that, you're not going to beat that long. And if you wanted to buy the Andrew Siliak commercial equivalent to an online cable, you'll spend, $1 or $2 as opposed to getting it for free. A little bit of mechanical engineering, putting those connectors on the end, and I own a special tool for installing the connectors. You can get a lot of low loss in a hurry with CATV hardline. And you can almost ignore the fact that it's 70 ohm and not 50 ohm. And if it does bother you, it's very easy to make an adapter for the end of the cable that converts 50 ohm to 70 ohm losslessly. You can want that last tenth of a dB because you're a moonbound operator. And a lot of moonbound operators are using CATV hardline because the price is right. Can't get lower loss cable that's more rugged than that. Made for direct burial in the ground for 20 years. So do consider that if you haven't already bought the cable. Gordon, I know you started off with no questions, but bet you've got one by now. W2, Tango, 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 K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. K2RIW, WW2TTT. Yeah, my question was, has anyone worked that new HiSat? It's got a CW beacon on 435 something, I think it is. It's also got a an input up there. I think that's right. And the output's on 2 meters somewhere. I was wondering if anyone's ever tried it and see how they've made out with it, what have they been using to get into it, et cetera, et cetera. Just kind of curious more than anything. Anyway, enjoyed the discussion, and just one question about your previous subject. That is, that 750 or 875 cable, if I'm not mistaken, has an aluminum jacket, so you have to use the appropriate goop to make sure that you don't screw yourself up with the bimetal junctions in copper and aluminum, things like that. But that's just something to think about. It sounds like a really good idea. As much as it has a fair quantity of LDF-450, but needs to go higher in frequency, and therefore might need something a little lower in loss. Yeah, that's certainly appealing. Although I had some old spiral kind of, precursor to LDF-450, or LDF-550, pardon me, LDF-550, 7/8 stuff, that finally went bad on me, and I had made connectors for it 10 years ago, and Either the connections have gone bad or there's been water ingress because it is air filled, and you know, I dressed everything up so that it wouldn't screw up, but as you say, eventually you get water in it no matter what you do, because it's air filled. So anyway, I'm in the process of pulling that down off my one tower and taking it to the metal recycling center to get paid like 30 to 40 cents a pound for it. So that's my question and my comment about the previous thing. K2RW2CDT.
Very fine, Gordon. In the case of 9913, the old fish and stuff that doesn't have the foil, and maybe the new stuff with the foil, if you're a really serious VHF operator and you want to make sure it doesn't give you any trouble, you will go through all the effort of pressurizing that cable. You'll put the right kind of a connector in the shack, and you'll have a very small amount of positive pressure of dry air continuously being pumped into the cable. That way the cable will not be breathing water no matter what you do. That's what they do with commercial hardline cables that are used on broadcast towers. Every single one of them is air-filled to get the lowest possible law. Every single one of them has a special little machine that takes the air from the atmosphere, puts it through a disking drying cell, and then takes the dry air and pumps it into the cable. That's half a pound per square inch or something very small. Just as long as it's a positive pressure, the cable never gets a chance to breathe. You do that, you get ridiculously high reliability to the cable. Now, for the average amateur to go through the rigmarole of pressurizing his cable sounds pretty tough. I know of two or three solutions to that. Guys at homebrewed things, which will have, you know, a small little pump that's intended for a fish tank, and it pumps air through a bunch of silica gel cells that are in a great big container of some kind. The air gets dried and then slowly pumped into the cable. And depending on how fast your cable leaks down, you either put a timer on the fish tank pump, the air pump for the fish tank, that just turns it on once every hour for a couple of seconds, or if your cable is really well installed and your gauge on it tells you that the leakage is so slow, you may only have to turn on the pump once every week or so. So pressurizing isn't that difficult. Or you can get yourself containers of Freon-like material. Back in the old days of Freon 12, if you read the side of the can of Freon 12, it's made to be an extremely dry substance. Well, you can't get Freon 12 anymore, but you can get the next best equivalent if you go to the right aftermarket store. Very few of them have it. They have something called Freon 12, which is the modern-day equivalent of Freon 12, but it's not a chlorofluorocarbon, but it acts the same. And it's got ridiculously high dryness. It costs you $2 a can, and when it's expanded from liquid form in the can into a gaseous form, it'll give you a ridiculously high volume. So it wouldn't take very much craftiness to pressurize your cable with either the freeze-12 material or with some kind of a fish tank and silica gel. Now, when it comes to the hardline cable, what makes the hardline cable such a crafty design is that, yes, it does have a fancy aluminum powder jacket. It's underneath a very tough polyethylene-like powder jacket. And the center conductor is also aluminum with a copper coating on top of the aluminum. So it's got the outer skin on the center conductor that is copper, that gives it the low laws, but there's very little copper there. That has a double advantage of making the cable not so expensive and a hell of a lot lighter. You cannot find any substitute cable of that diameter at anywhere near that lower law, at anywhere near that lighter weight, an extremely well-designed substance. And yes, the connector you put on it is made to go directly onto the aluminum outer jacket and be compatible, particularly if you put the silicon grease on the outer rubber seal. The front end of the connector, the 5H24 thread, I'm not sure if it's aluminum or not, but to be on the safe side, Gabe's got a darn good idea. Make sure you put some no-lock, some other kind of compound on those threads. Although modern-day UG21 connectors are made in such a way that they are compatible with copper bearing. In other words, they've got nickel plating or whatever if you're buying a good brand of tight end connector. So the metallic interface there isn't too much of a problem. The only place it would give you a problem, because the threads give you such a good RF contact, even if aluminum oxide built up there, I don't think RF-wise you'd be in trouble. if at some later time you want to take the connector apart and you've got dissimilar metals, they might seize if you don't put the no-lock substance in there. So that's a darn good suggestion. Now, Gabe's original question was the new HiSat satellite. Has anyone used it? I don't think we've got a great number of satellite users on Long Island, but I may be wrong. So if you know anything about the HiSat satellite, the one that's putting out a signal at 435 megacycles right now, give us your call letters at the time. K2RIW in the second half.
W2ZL repeater.
Yeah, we didn't get an answer on that one. The last guy I knew who at one time was heavily involved in satellites was K2OVS. Jabe used to send me K2 Oscar Victor Susan when he used to live in St. James. Now that he lives out on the North Fork in Laurel, Long Island, I think he is not as much involved in satellite work. I've been hearing tell of a man who lives in the Petrograd area who is pretty heavy into satellites. I can't remember his call letters right now. I don't know if he and I have ever had a face-to-face. But there is one man living in Petrograd who does make a lot of use of the amateur satellites. His set of call letters are written on my desk at the salt mine. I'll be finding that out tomorrow, Gabe. And so worst comes to worst, either you and I will have an email exchange on that one, or we'll call each other on the phone, or you'll wait till next Sunday, and I'll give you that guy's call letters. But the report I received on Friday is that the man in Petrograd is very heavily involved in satellites. Thank you, Gordon. Drag your feet a little bit in case we do have a satellite maven out there. W2TTT, KQRIW in the second half.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you, Dick. And no big deal. Maybe I'll go get the orbital elements for it. Figure out when its next pass is. You know, I got one of those Mauna type orbits. You know, spent a lot of time in the northern hemisphere and not too much in the southern. So I'll go track that down and pump it into some satellite tracking program and see where it should be, and we'll go from there. I'll try it. I mean, what the heck? I mean, I've got the ability to, if nothing else, point the small 432 Yagi directly at the bird. Not too worried about receiving it on 2 meters. I don't think that's going to be a major problem here either. So we'll see. But, you know, it's a single channel kind of FM bird, I think, plus a CW beacon on one frequency. So I'll go try to listen for it, and away we go. Alright, let me not take up more time than that, but thank you very much, and that was very informative on the cable. K2RAW W2TTT. I'll just listen out.
Very fine, Gordon. What Gordon was mentioning, some of the more modern amateur satellites are doing what the commercial people did 15, 20 years ago. What's called a Malinya or Malinya orbit. It's a Russian name, I think named for a particular Russian town. In the Siberia area, it needed to transmit television to those people. Couldn't possibly install all the cable TV required, all the wiring for cable TV for a town that lives in the tundra. So they invented a kind of a high altitude, highly elliptical orbit, which makes, I believe it's 2 orbits per day. But during one of those orbits per day, at prime time, like 8 o'clock at night, the satellite is directly over Siberia at the height of its altitude, and it hangs there for like 10 hours. And then it goes back to the low altitude portion on the backside of the Earth, so to speak. It's a quasi-sun synchronous orbit. In other words, when the orbit is set up correctly at the right altitude, the right ellipticity ratio, and the right inclination of orbit, the orbit slowly precesses such that it'll be right over your town at 8 o'clock at night, prime time, every day of the week for the next number of years. So that kind of a satellite, if it happens to have the right orbit over your part of the world, is a very handy orbit, because we're at the apogee, and the highest part of its orbit is near synchronous altitude, and it sweeps across the sky extremely slowly. Very little antenna aiming is required to track that particular bird, and you can talk to it for many hours at a time. Whereas the low altitude orbit birds come swishing by, if they go directly over your house, they go from horizon to horizon in 18 minutes. And if they're a little bit off of being directly over your house, you may only see it come above the horizon for 4 minutes. And those kind of cues, those are hello, goodbye, send me a card. Whereas with a Mountaineer orbit type satellite, you can talk to it for maybe 5 hours at a time, maybe even longer. And therefore, you can have a nice rag chew with a guy, essentially on the other half of the Earth. In other words, if the orbit's in the right position, you may talk to your buddy in London on VHF, UHF, through the satellite for 3 solid hours. And it's, except for the time delay, it's like a telephone conversation. Time delay meaning a third of a second up to the bird, back down. So, but since we amateurs tend to talk simplex and not duplex, usually that doesn't hurt. So these modern-day satellites are going to be fun. We'll eventually be putting up a, I guess in case it's called a Phase 4 satellite, which will be thoroughly synchronous. It would be nice to have one over the Pacific Ocean area, one over the Atlantic Ocean area, and one over the Asian area, and with some kind of a tie-in between the two, and then we amateurs can talk 24 hours a day, worldwide, using those satellites, with an antenna that's locked onto the side of the tower, aimed at a particular point in space, and if the satellite has enough accuracy of its address in orbit, the antenna never has to be moved, and you're making a VHF, UHF, or SHF, then those are the frequency ranges, VHF 30 to 300 megs, UHF 300 to 3,000, SHF 3,000 to 3 gigs, 3,000 to 30,000. On one of those frequencies, you aim an antenna at the point in the sky, it talks to the bird talks to the world, and so now you've got a repeater in the sky, where instead of the repeater being on a building 250 feet above sea level and covering 50 miles, you've got a bird that's 22,300 miles up, and it covers almost 50% of planet Earth all at once. That's a repeater. So we're all looking forward to that next phase of the AMSAT satellite, which eventually will be one in synchronous orbit. A little bit difficult to get into synchronous orbit to get the permission to build the bird. It's complicated enough to do that, to have the power, the antenna gains. On top of that, when you do have a satellite in synchronous orbit, the usual Intelsat rules are that that satellite will stay within a 1 cubic mile area. That's your address in space. You will stay within that 1 cubic mile, otherwise you start paying a fine. Because if you drift out of that area, you're going to start running into other satellites, and people are going to be very unhappy with you if their 400 megabuck bird gets ruined by your piece of junk running into it from their point of view. So you got to be awful careful with that kind of a scenario, as you can see. So it'll be a while before we amateurs put up a thoroughly synchronous bird, and I think it's on the way. And with any comments on that subject before we go on, give me a call at us right now. KTYWMTechNet.
N2MB, of course.
N2 Mike Bravo. Hey, there's a satellite user from way back. I hope Gabe is still with us. Gabe was asking, no, it wasn't Gabe, it was Gordon, was asking about the Hindsat. Bet you've got some information on that, Barry. Tell us everything you know on the subject. N2 Moonbound, KTYWMTechNet.
Okay, I wish I had a lot of good news. I have some news, but not wonderful news. Anyway, just a few little things. The geosynchronous height, I think, is 22,500 or 400, somewhere in there. These Millennium Orbit, or however you want to pronounce it, tend to go well above that, which is curious. They can get up as high as 60,000 miles. I think 58,000 miles is as far out as Oscar 40 got. That's because of the orbit. They don't really go into geosynchronous, of course. They go into this weird millennial orbit, and they get very low, and they get very high. But when they get higher than geosynchronous. They go right through that part of the sky. They don't go through that part of the sky, but they reach elevations which are, in fact, higher. And you might want to mention, because nobody ever does, don't worry not, but the French, you know, the ones that are responsible for American fries and all that stuff, they had an orbit satellite called Arsene, which unfortunately only lasted a short time. It was up there for less than a month. But it had a different orbit. It was going around kind of above the geo belt, and it was drifting, but it was drifting. drifting slowly, and it did go up and down a little bit. It wasn't a perfectly round orbit. But that one was actually in view from us for 26 hours before it drifted out of view, and then about 8 or 12 hours later, it would be back in view again for another 26 hours. I love that orbit. That was a little different. That was just a very high, slow...